Hey, y'all, this is Monica. This is my third highlight reel, the final installment of my Best Of series, which is a three-parter on the multipolar world order with Ian Davis. Thank you so much for your patience while I put together some of these older shows. I hope you've enjoyed them the second time around, a little bit tightened up, and I'm going to be back in the saddle next week and coming at you with some solo shows, some interviews, catching up on all the conversations I missed out on. I hope you enjoy this. Thanks for listening. So I've always wondered how we have this, what looks like East-West competition, what looks like Western dominance. And now with Ukraine war and other events, some competition with China, it looks like there's this bipolar world reemerging, a Cold War reemerging. Yet I look behind the scenes and for decades we've been, you could start with Kissinger and Nixon or I don't know who, Rockefellers, have been feeding, say, technology or military, important military devices or ideas to the Chinese and given them a leg up. And now we act like we're afraid of them. I can never circle the square on how we can compete with them and also foster them at the same time. But I think that your series answers that question. And the answer I would say to jump to the punchline would be that regionalism is a stepping stone to global governance. Where did I get that wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. And that's always been the idea. We can go back. You can go back thousands of years if you like, but the idea is to have power structures that are manageable. Now, in a world of 193 or an expanding number of countries, that's a lot of different poles of potential conflict and potential power plays and so forth, and with nation states perhaps having their own regional interests and it's difficult to impose a system of, and so I think we need to draw a distinction here, a system of genuine global governance. We've had many, many attempts to establish global governance, for example, the United Nations, which started out as a public-private partnership in the post-war period with the Rockefellers were very much influential in bringing that together. But it doesn't have, perhaps didn't have the teeth that they would have liked. So in order to impose genuine global governance, you've got 193 factions, or the members of the United Nations, 190 whatever it is, countries that are in the assembly who are debating issues. Now the assembly doesn't really have any power, but that's a separate issue. But they've all got their own interests. So that's quite a difficult system to manage. But if you can break them up into blocks, if you can get them to align with each other into blocks, then you don't have to manage it. You don't have to micromanage it.
So I just want to clarify that is that, first of all, yes, I agree with you. I've read about the origins of the UN. I think it was Alger Hiss in San Francisco, if I remember correctly. And they did, they toyed with the idea, and I think it was taxation and law enforcement that would be the real pillars of a world government, and they did not feel they could achieve that, and they didn't. And I have, over the years, looked back at when, you see Putin appealing to the UN and saying, like, the U.S. is violating these treaties, and why do they not recognize international law? And I'm always like, why is he appealing to that? And the UN sometimes actually does do the right thing. And I've always been totally puzzled by that. They actually respond sometimes to the minority or to smaller members. But then when you introduce this concept of regionalism, it seems to me that then you get this, the smaller people, the smaller parties to feel like they have an ally in the larger stage. And they know that they're weak as individual countries, but they feel like, oh, if I have this block then maybe all together we can stand up to this other block. And while that there may be real competition at the top of that block to give that credibility, all of a sudden you have what are called like non-aligned nations pretty much aligned with one leader or another. And there has to be a little bit of PSYOP kind of optics there of controlled opposition at the top, or at least nobody's really going to get anything done if he's not a leader who can, quote, compromise. So I think there are probably some genuine dynamics there, but to think of it this way, that it all plugs in like that, it's like Machiavellian, but it seems like the most likely scenario. The one thing that brings all those, that makes this make sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, I mean, there are other advantages to doing it from a kind of economic perspective as well, which is something which is very, very much part of the kind of geopolitical and geoeconomic sort of strategy in the great, in Klaus Schwab and Thierry Malarey's book, The Great Reset. But also it pervades through the actual kind of Great Reset strategic plans and all that kind of thing as well. But if you, the idea as well is to break down economies into the global economy. Because if you're hoping to impose a system of control over the global economy, a genuine system of control over the global economy, then again, it works on a similar principle. And that's the, of breaking down the supply chains into more manageable chunks. So very much a part of the opportunity that the World Economic Forum talk about is the break, what they call the breakdown of the globalization. And that, but they say that the dangers, and this is where the need for global governance comes from, because in this tumultuous multipolar world that where you've got these different poles emerging and the end of a global hegemon, the breakdown of globalization causes conflicts and causes friction in markets. So when you get friction in markets, that's the perfect opportunity to come in and manage those markets. So that is very much a big part of, I would suggest, of what the plan is, if there is a plan, if you could look
at it. No, okay. Well, that actually talks to like three things I have from the first half of the part three article, which can be found at iandavis.com, right? IAINDAVIS.com.
Yeah.
Okay, so these articles we'll never cover, well worth reading. So three different things emerge from what you just said in my mind. One is I'm puzzled by this idea of, or just want you to clarify, when you say it's more manageable to break it down into regions, I look at the World Economic Forum, I look at the Dow Jones Industrial, and I just see global corporations who want to be the monopoly in their field. But what you're talking about is an oligopoly in the field, so that there's more than one player on the world stage in each industry. Just to clarify, that is correct?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's... So then there's also the fact that international finance is like mycelium in a forest. It is the network that pins the whole thing together. So international.
Oh, I see. So BlackRock is one one company. And yes, maybe there's going to be someone who competes with Salesforce in China.
Yeah.
But they're all plugging in to, that's true. Like BlackRock would pretty much control the world then, yeah.
Because it's a compartmentalized hierarchical structure.
Right. And then they don't have to write. It's kind of like the modular thing that Rosa Quar used to talk about how like you need to make sure that every system is regular and works the exact same way so that you can monitor it from on high. There's no real... it has to be more digital than analog because you can't give it special attention. But if you have three companies that operate two, they can plug into Larry Fink, all he needs is one guy in each place and it's just as good as him owning the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right. And so another thing I want to say about this is, and so an element of that would be at the most basic level, the way Starbucks like destroys all mom and pop coffee shops, like the real threat is local competition. It's a real problem is that I think local individual companies that don't have to have like conglomerates who can actually just make the best coffee for that town, that's a real threat. And so what you want to do is, because that you can't control and they suck up. I really feel like this is mostly just them sucking up every penny of surplus in the system anywhere. So it would take care of that too.
Yeah, that's a fantastic analogy, actually. I wish I'd thought of that. because I mean, if you think about it, if your target is monopoly, right? Your target is monopoly, so not just in one town, but in another town, in all the other towns. It's very difficult to convince the local customers not to go to the local coffee shop. They've got relationships with these people. They love the coffee. You know, they've got a reason to go there. They might not even mind paying a bit more just to maintain those relationships and to just to maintain their local coffee store, coffee shop. So in order to get that for you to be able to stamp your authority on not only that coffee shop, but all the other ones in similar position, you need to introduce some sort of structural failure. So if you introduce a structural failure, then the coffee shops go down like dominoes, and then you can come in and...
Yes, and that's what happened in COVID. And you can also impose that artificially with draconian regulations, regulatory barriers to entry. But this leads me to the next question I had, or point from the first half of part three, is that you make one sentence that just really clarifies something I've been trying to articulate, that failed rules cry out for new rules. And that would explain what looks to me very manufactured failures of the supply chain and of democracy. And of course, of the pseudo pandemic, like they act like our health system doesn't, you know, or our immune system is not. I mean, that was manufactured as well. Mm. They are all the same. But I feel like the supply chain failures, you can get to the bottom of, like, they seem preposterous when you analyze them. And the way democracy was totally working fine, and you have these agents provocateurs, like, don't use the process, just turn tables over. And it's like, that's not how America was. We had that Bush-Gore thing, and there was no protests even. Everyone just waited around and then grumbled. That was it.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at the kind of the ideology beyond that. I mean, you can go back and look at people like Schumpeter and that for kind of creative destruction and all that kind of idea.
Yes.
But fundamentally, the idea, as you quite rightly pointed out there, is that in order to establish, for want of a better expression, a new order, you have to degrade the old one. You have to degrade the old one because your objective is to get the people who are using the current order. So they're actively using it. So they've got no need to change something that is functioning for them. You know, if, for example, whether that's a political system, an economic system, a financial system, whatever it might be, if it's working, why do you need to reinvent the wheel? So in order to reinvent the wheel, you have to break the old wheel apart. And that is precisely what they're doing on a global scale,
right?
With what was, I suppose, the whole idea, whether it's a unipolar world order or whether you want to call it the international rules-based system or the kind of the way that the power balance has worked in the post, really in the post-Cold War, but also in the post-war period, that is not the way of the future. That's not the envisaged future, and it never was the envisaged long-term future. So what they want to do now is smash that to pieces to bring in the new order, and the new order will be a redistributed balance of power, because with that becomes a redistribution of everything from energy flows to currency to economics, everything. You distribute it so you've got a broader market where you can then capitalize on the new markets, having already sucked the old markets dry.
Okay.
So you're creating new markets.
This also makes me think that you bring this out, and I remember from report from Iron Mountain, you're right, like this is not new. It's just clearly true. So, I mean, that you could look into the occult. A lot of people spend time doing that. But this stuff was written down and it really is unfolding and it continues to. And one of the points there was that these problems must be global. They must be global so that we can justify a global solution. And I think I actually said, I was speculating, like, what are things that could be global? And I thought climate change, whatever, pollution, which they don't focus on because they want to keep doing that, I think. Plague, aliens, and like religious fanaticism, because religions are pretty global right now. Maybe that's the terrorism or whatever. They are talking about aliens. But what they landed basically on the climate thing and the plague thing, I think you bring this out because humanity then is the problem. And then they can deindustrialize, they can push down, and then they justify one thing that I do believe, it seems like to me, is that in one way, like making this more, you were saying, like broaden it, that would take from them if it didn't take from the people. So I would say, or from the masses, whatever. So I say they are actually trying to push the middle class down. And if you set up no expectation of surplus or savings or anything with just hand to mouth, like total safety net all the time, then there is no way that they can actually hang on to any of the surplus at the bottom. And so even if there's less surplus, it's way more, it is entirely captured by the top. Is that too abstract, do you think? Am I going too far?
No, not at all. If you look at things like we used in the analogy earlier of the mycelium for finance, the flow of finance, that works in so many other parts of our society as well. So for example, the class structure. So traditionally, if you look at things like the French Revolution for so forth, you know, you've got either it's coming from the working class or it's coming from the middle class, but it's when the middle class become activated that you start to get social change. So that is when the people are controlling the process of social change. Well, if you want to dominate, you don't want the people to be in charge of social change. You want to be leading the social change. So what you need to do is level the playing field. You don't want to have the ability of one group of people to lead society when really you only want the very, very top to lead society. So you don't want an active, functioning, questioning
right.
middle class.
That's why, that's why the progressive taxes are for that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Progressive taxation, because as somebody who's like going up through the levels of, you know, the older you get, the higher your tax bracket, basically, it just absorbs so much more of the surplus that you have to keep working until you're just exhausted with life. And then you're not going to Washington when you're 65. You're just like, oh, thank God. Like, I'm just going to, you know, sit on the golf course or whatever. I just feel like they do that intentionally, because plus that's the professional class. That is, I always think of the French Revolution as that. It's like that bourgeoisie. It's like they were the ones who had the money. They were the ones who had the education. They were the ones who could really be a threat, and they were close to it. They could see it, and they could see that the upper classes didn't deserve, like that ruling class didn't deserve that kind of grotesque opulence. Mm-hmm. And we have that now. And I really feel like that can only be achieved with the help of regulatory barriers to entry or other kind of systemic problems with just free markets and free trade and everything. They actually have to keep that from happening, or some of that wealth will just settle back down, and they have to be very active about keeping those barriers, I think. And I mean, again, I might be getting too abstract.
So if you take something like quantitative easing or something like that, what are you basically doing? You're printing money out of thin air. You're just printing funny money, which in theory, you know, if you listen to people that talk about trickle-down economics and so forth, that should theoretically, that should, you know, enable an eventual distribution of wealth. But it never does, because it always gets, because they don't want that to happen. They don't want that to happen. And, you know, they don't want people to start being better off and start having kind of a greater share of prosperity. Now, if the general level of prosperity goes up, that's fine, because that's good for the people, because the people will be happy with that. They got better standard of education, better standard of healthcare, better, you know, infrastructure, that kind of thing. That's fine. They just don't want them to have a greater share of it. So the more you produce, the more that you have to siphon off through mechanisms like, for example, things like the derivatives market, where you can just throw money at it all day and it just disappears into this black hole of corruption. And, you know, I mean, it just absorbs the GDP of the planet many, many, many times over. So that's a way of increasing, quote unquote, growth, increasing wealth, but and broadly speaking, improving perhaps even the lives of people in terms of things that we just talked about, education system and so forth, but never actually giving them a greater share of that wealth. So what happens is, if you look throughout history, if you even now, I mean, look at recently. So if we take, for example, somewhere like, for example, China, China's had an economic miracle, you know, in many ways. I mean, a lot of the poverty has been alleviated. There's still poverty like there is everywhere else in the world, but a lot of poverty has been alleviated. There's a burgeoning middle class and so forth. But if you look at China from a wealth inequality perspective, the concentration of wealth at the top of society has never been greater. So while there's this kind of lifting, the concentration of, and what comes with wealth, power, consolidation of power, consolidation of authority,
control of the institutions.
Yeah. So that if you're going to lift the masses up, it has always been, and you can look throughout history, you can look wherever this has happened, wherever the masses benefit from a general economic improvement or whatever it might be, the consolidation and the centralization of power and authority, whether it's overt or covert, increases. Always.
I feel like every 10 years there's a crash, and because they bail out, like, it just drives me crazy that every 10 years, you know, since I've been really thinking about it, there are these huge crashes, and they really don't let these things go completely under. So the same people who usher in, I mean, the perfect example is Ben Bernanke got the Nobel Prize, you know?
Yeah.
He's the reason this great reset, like, had to be so devastating. But I feel like a reset every 10 years, reset means 2-0. And it's like, you've got that surplus and they're like, okay, you can raise your standard of living, but whatever's in the bank has got to go. Like, you know, we're going to take that.
Well, I mean, if you look at some of the work of people like Professor Richard Werner, and if you look at kind of the stuff that John Titus has been talking about, and you know, that's the way that the system operates is mechanisms like inflation. So, you know, obviously at the moment we're going through a very bad period of inflation. Inflation is a stealth tax. There's always been a stealth tax because we have this idea of trickle down. You know, when the money is first created, which causes inflation, the people that are the first adopters of that money, the people to get hold of it first, i.e. the financial markets, they get it at the value that it was created. By the time it trickles down to us, inflation has got hold of it, and the value of that money is depreciated by however many percent. In the meantime, the assets that the people that bought, that had that money in the first place, the assets that they've have got with that money has gone up in value. So they win.
And that's why I have two things for you. That's why Keynes talked about sticky wages.
Yeah.
He inflation is a way to keep people from to lower wages without people realizing.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a situation at the moment where a lot has been made about the fact that the Transport and Workers Union and other unions in the UK have been going on strike and talking about things like a 17% pay rise. So everyone's going, it's discussed. No one's ever had a 17% pay rise. But of course, it's not a 17% pay rise.
Right.
If you take the base rate of inflation, it's more like a 6% pay rise.
And
if
from when?
But yeah, but then if you then go back, you know, only not that far, just 5 or 6 years, Even the pay rise that they're asking for is still not going to bring them back to parity to where they were 6 years ago. So
yeah, so I have my little poem I'm going to tell you. Roses are red, violets are blue. Taxation is theft. Inflation is too. There you go. So my little Austrian poem.
Very good.
And if you go back to the 19th century, was I telling this last time? I might have. I was helping my second grader when he was young do a little project where we were looking at the price of milk. And I said, look at the price. I don't know what the project was, but I made it about inflation. The price of milk in 1800, the price of milk in 1900, and the price of milk in 2000. And it's hard to find, but if you looked at it, I think it was like the same from 1800 to 1900. And then it was, you know, like many times over the next 100 years. So, and I looked, and at the same time that the price of milk was absolutely flat, wages went up during the 19th century. And I think that's when the powers that be were like, we got to stop this American thing because it's working.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you get things like the Cantillon effect and stuff like that, where basically it's all taxation stuff. But as you quite rightly say, inflation is the worst stealth tax of them all.
And so that was when the Fed came in like 1913, I think. And that's when it all changed.
So that's also, is it a coincidence? I would suggest not. That is also playing out now. The boom and bust cycle. Yeah. This is, can anyone really point at the current situation and say that this is not deliberately engineered? It's obvious, isn't it? It's obviously deliberately engineered, right?
We've had to be blind on purpose.
Yeah. So I mean, we've had the what I would call the pseudo pandemic, and then we've got this conflict in Europe, the breakdown, the consequent claim for the need for the breakdown of supply chains, which has continued and then exacerbated with the conflict. That creates exactly the economic, Schumpeter's creative destruction. That's what's happening.
Now that you bring it up, I must ask you about, and I believe this is in the beginning of part four. You point out something that has been driving me crazy. Also, the level of coordination on the COVID thing from event 201, where the Chinese CDC was sitting shoulder to shoulder with the US CDC. They were with the global corporations. They laid the whole thing out of exactly what was happening, to the point where, based on event 201, I called the day that the stock market hit bottom. It was like March something. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'd had the money, I would have been able to really profit on it, because it was that day. They said 40%. It was 40%, very close to that. So they obviously unrolled this whole thing in lockstep. Nobody said, you didn't see Putin saying like, this thing is manufactured. We're the vaccine. People don't need vaccines for this, whatever. Nobody said that. Yet we now have big tensions with China, but the Ukraine war, which looks very real, like that is really looks real. But how can parties that are so coordinated in one way on one day be so completely at odds later? It's hard to make that fit together.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that they are completely at odds. Not even in the conflict. I mean, if we think about it, I mean, there are certain things that are unusual about the conflict, I would suggest. For one thing, Russia has had unopposed air dominance, unopposed air dominance in Ukraine throughout the whole thing.
Well, who would oppose it?
Well, no one, exactly. There isn't anyone to oppose it, right? So they've got complete air command.
And that was predictable, right?
But I mean, the only people that could oppose it would be somebody like NATO, but they can't.
Yeah, I mean,
oppose
that
it
would because, be a big,
yeah, yeah.
Right. So they must have seen that coming when they provoked this.
Exactly. But they haven't really used it. They've got supposedly the best air defense systems in the world. And yet, with using, you know, questionably pretty rubbish sometimes, Western cast off cheap, missile systems, the Ukrainians seem to be able to strike, places like the DPR and the LPR, or not the new, obviously, Russian Federation republics, with relative ease. Why? When Russia's got the best air defenses in the world. How does that work?
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
so they're pulling their punches. Russia is staged.
You know, I don't think right. So this is the other. I was talking to somebody else about this the other day. The conflict in terms of its in terms of the reasons why, for example, you know, the people in the East following the Maidan coup definitely wanted to first initially defend themselves, and then there was the 8-year war, and then, you know, so that there are deep-rooted, very real reasons why there would be an internal conflict in Ukraine, which has escalated into, you know, basically separatism and the whole thing that's happening at the moment. And also, you can see from a Russian, I guess, nationalist point of view, that they would see that as a legitimate cause, you know, that there's a reason there to go in there and basically save their fellow Russians.
Yeah, I totally think that's true.
Though. Yeah, basically save their fellow Russians and their
you
fellow
Russians.
You don't
think Russians. That's true?
Yeah, no, I think there is that nationalist aspect to it.
Yeah.
But the people that are managing things like the global economy that are, you know, as Rahm Emanuel said, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? So if there's an opportunity to stick an oar in and to make the situation worse, or to just sit back and allow things to... I mean, we recently heard comments from Merkel, Germany's former chancellor, who's saying that Minsk was just some kind of setup, really, just so that they could stall it for a while Ukraine got an opportunity to arm. I mean, she says that now. I mean, I personally think that's a bit far-fetched, but that's what she said.
And they didn't, right? I mean, Ukraine wasn't really super well prepared, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, but I mean, the West was sending arms to Ukraine from the Maidan onwards.
Until the Trump impeachment, you know, seemed like a setup too. Like, that seemed like a real setup. So the Minsk thing she was saying was, because I missed this, she said Minsk was a setup, meaning that the West was just stalling Russia so that they could prepare for the war.
She basically said that, you know, everybody realized that that war was likely, and that their task basically was to stall it for as long as possible to give Ukraine the opportunity to prepare. Basically, but then that, you know, the flip side of that. So what are you saying? Because the Russians are sitting on the other side of that. And, you know, what are they? Just patsies. They don't know what's going on. They can't figure that out for themselves. I mean, this is where it all starts to get, in my mind, very confusing. I haven't got an answer to this, by the way. This is,
Putin had to wait. Putin was always pulling his punch. I think he had to wait until he could justify it to his own people. Is that not?
Well,
he had to wait until they kept provoking and kept provoking provoking.
So then you get into this. Well, if that's the case, so so he wants there to be an escalating conflict so that he can then justify.
That's the thing. It's a little schizophrenic, because I would think just on the surface of it, he wanted to resolve it in a way that they would stop killing people in, Donetsk and Lugansk, or however you pronounce that. So that they would stop killing those people, and that they could have that kind of quasi-autonomous thing, which obviously wasn't happening. And when Russian's illegal as a language, you're really not going to be able to have self-governance. They had to take that stuff away. And he probably knew it was never going to happen, but I assume that he couldn't just go pop off until it was so obvious that he could get support from his people, that like they would beg him to save their, you know, Russian language brothers across the border. That's how I read it. And I'm not saying, I don't think Putin's a hero. I just felt like that seemed kind of straightforward. But it also seemed like the West was absolutely provoking it by not fulfilling the Minsk agreement, and by saying, well, we're going to make Ukraine and Georgia or whatever enter NATO. Like, they were provoking. And I have a Rand Corporation document from 2019, which weighs the costs and benefits of provocation. No, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, we were talking earlier, how do these things just work? Well,
yeah,
answered your own question.
Yeah, because because the COVID thing, they were so coordinated, and they're still kind of coordinated. Yeah. They're still playing into that. And yet with the Ukraine thing, okay, and then I guess the punchline on the Ukraine thing that brings it, okay, so COVID going in makes it look like we all cooperate. And the way that they are, two things about the Ukraine thing, that they're pushing them to accelerate the CBDC, that's one thing. And then the other thing is that I think it says in your article, and I think this is true, that Putin's still getting gas, even though the Nord Stream thing is up in the air. He's still getting gas through Ukraine to Europe, which was the big thing. And it reminds me of World War II, where the money kept clearing regardless. Germany, UK, made the money flows, I believe, never stopped during World War II. Like 60 million people died. Yeah. Nobody at the top really was really like, well, that's going too far. Like not letting the banks clear, that's going too far. So not letting the gas flow, like that's going too far. That just shows a coordination at the top. But the CBDC thing is the real, like, obvious one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you know, that situation, that was, so Gazprom had got existing contracts that they needed to fulfill that were, they had a contractual dispute with, I can't remember, I think they're called Naftgas, the Ukrainian gas transit company that transits the gas through to Europe. So there was a contractual dispute that was going on separate to the conflict. This has nothing to do with the conflict. This, in fact, I think it even predated the conflict. So the contractual dispute was going on.
Right.
But then the war started. But then they resolved the contractual dispute, right? And so the gas started flowing again.
So that's just totally separate.
Yeah, like that's got nothing. But the point is, Gazprom is Russian state-owned.
Right.
Right. So this is the Russian government supplying gas direct. But more to the point, once the gas was turned back on, even though it was in greatly reduced volumes, I mean, it was about a sixth or about 10%. Well, no, it was a bit more. I think it was about 20% of what would normally go through. But nonetheless, EU customers were still buying it. So they're providing weapons to Ukraine to fight the Russians. Russian soldiers are dying, but the Russian government is selling gas to the people that are killing, or basically paying for their own troops to be killed.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, that just makes it, that shows, I hate to use the chessboard analogy because Q hijacked it, but I mean, that just shows that there's something happening at this level, and it does happen. You know, people are dying. It does happen.
Oh, God, yeah, people are dying.
People,
it's horrendous what's going on, yeah.
Will people be cold this winter?
It's worse than that. I personally think, I mean, but this is very much about sustainable development as well. It's a terrible thing to say, but there are many people in Europe, the most vulnerable people, especially the old elderly people, the older people, are going to die. They're going to be killed by this. They're not, and I don't want to even think about numbers, but I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that a lot of people are going to die.
Like COVID did that. It's hard.
Yeah, So, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, the EU's kind of net zero type kind of commitment is called Repower EU. And they are trying to go towards an all renewable or 80% renewable by, I think, 2035 or 2030 or whatever it is, right? Now, there is no way that they can meet the energy requirements of the EU as a bloc with renewables with the current state of technology. They just cannot do it. It's physically impossible. But in the drive to do that, they've shut down coal-fired power stations. They've shut down
gas power stations.
So now you've got situations in Germany, for example. In 2021, Germany was on the brink of blackouts and power shutdowns. You've got people, you know, being told, the EU have warned their own citizens to expect energy rationing. Oh, right? So this goes full circle back to where we first started this conversation. It is the breakdown of, it is the creative destruction, it's the deconstruction of the current system. And then what are you going to do? You smash the thing that was working apart, and then you say, but don't worry, we have a solution, which is going to be the multipolar world order, a global synthetic hegemonic currency, and the new world order.
I coined an expression, ROM Emanuel 2.0. where if you don't have the crisis you need, create it.
Yeah.
So this is a Rahm Emanuel 2.0 moment. But one thing that it's what I suspected and it validated me to read it in your article is that the not just oligarchs. So behind a lot of this stuff is oligarchy. So these are actual individuals who have this symbiotic relationship with the state, the way you described it, where the public money will go into private or semi-private companies where these guys are, a handful, 100, whatever, of multi-billionaires who then put their money and influence back into promoting, let's call them state objectives. But like, I think we've gotten so fascism with this stuff that there really isn't a state. Like, how would you define a state? The state serves the corporations now or these oligarchs, not us. They're not a manifestation of our will or agency. And then because it's like that, you have people, elites, including political elites, not just business elites, whatever, or financial elites, who sell us out, as the way you put it, for a better seat at the table, or even I would say just a bigger piece of a bigger pie, or a bigger piece of a smaller pie, whatever. There is that element of oligarchs, public, private. Like, how does that drive this? Because I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I don't talk about and one thing that I kind of resist and not, it's funny because I had a bit of a row with someone the other day about this, as I don't think that there is this one monolithic, overarching, global conspiracy that, you know, that there's going to be this central power is dominant and that it can rule the world and that it's pulling all the strings from
the committee of 300,
the committee of 300 or something like that.
You don't think that's the way it works. That's not in the top of the pyramid.
I think there are other elements that you might look at to say who is actually at the top of the pyramid. And I don't think we know because
the committee of 300 is a lot. That's more like not a conspiracy. It's not control. It's not control.
I mean, that shows a good, that kind of corporate development of the British East India Company and all that kind of thing, the way that moved into a new level of corporatism, that is quite an interesting thing. But also you can go back even further. You can go back to the Venetian bankers. You can go back to the black nobility, and there's many, many questions.
No, more. I don't know these things. I mean, I've heard them, but like,
so there's many.
I don't know.
This is a field. Okay. This is something that I'm looking at the moment, but I don't know that much about it. But certainly, you've got if you go all the way back to the Phoenicians, if you're talking about how capital controls populations. But that's beside the point. I digress now. What were we talking about?
Well, I was just saying the oligarchs are behind it. And you're saying but
it's more like, this is the way I perceive it. It's more like a global network that has got a shared trajectory. So the ambition is to establish fully functioning global governance, which has never been achieved before. Even though, the Roman Empire might have thought it was in charge of the world, that's because it didn't know what the whole world, this is the first time in human history that the potential for real global power has existed, but it hasn't been established yet. So therefore, you've got this network which has got a history that goes back thousands of years. So you've got this.
Oh, okay. So it's not necessarily a monolithic conspiracy, but it is a network with a millennia's old history.
Yeah, it's human. It's human nature. It's human nature, where people are consolidating power and they're passing it on to their children, and they're creating. So from a Chinese perspective, you see the rise and the fall of the dynasties. If you look at people that look at things called something called elite theory, where you look at the oligarchs. I can't remember what was his name. Federico, I can't remember the guy's name. But he used to talk about the cyclical nature of the oligarchy. So people come into it and they go out of it. Fortunes change. People that rise to the top of the markets and are sitting there for 50, 60 years, you know, a change in technology can depose them in the matter of a couple of years. So these things happen, and you get this constant shift and this flux, but collectively they're a network with shared interests. They have a shared interest, and their shared interest is and always has been to consolidate and centralize more power to themselves. Not because it suits, because it's in their interest. It's
like external economies of scale, kind of like where it's, if you've got the power base and you have a seat at the table, I mean, but they're, how competitive do you think it is within the network?
So this,
like,
is why
is any idiot trying to like disrupt that by taking too much?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see things like, I mean, there's an interesting thing that happened with the multi-billionaire head of Alibaba Group and Alipay and Tencent, Jack Ma.
Yeah.
Jack Ma. So Jack Ma stuck his head above the parapet and started getting a bit bolshy about what. Right. So what happened? You know, he was taken to task, and his business was devalued by $76 billion in one day. So
fascinated by what happens to these Chinese billionaires when they get out of line. They disappear sometimes.
Well, he did. He disappeared for 3 months, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but he's not the only one.
No, there's many. I mean, there's tremendous corruption that has happened, you know.
Travis Kalanick, the guy who was the head of Uber, they kept trying to get rid of him, and he wouldn't budge. He stood in the way of government surveillance. It was called Operation Greyball. And his parents were in a horrible boating accident. And then he stepped down. And I was like, that looks super fishy to me. And I think it was fishy. But I think that's my example of, like, you've got this billionaire who just is not playing his role. And he did not know, you know, that they show him the Zapruder film and they're like, that was us.
maybe that's why he stayed quiet. That's a perfectly good, why didn't I just say that would have been much easier?
It's like a mob, so it's like,
yeah, you know, so yeah. you've got people vying for, and organizations and groups vying. But and someone, you know, saying, well, how can that work? Well, it works like any global corporation when you think about it. You get people at the middle management level. They're all backstabbing each other and trying to scramble above and get above the next guy and then the next woman and then blah, blah, blah. And they're all trying to do this. Then you get boardroom, you know, blowouts. And then you get people that are at then you get buyouts and mergers and acquisitions. You get all this kind of stuff happening. But no one in that whole system wants the corporation to fail. They're all working for the benefit of the corporation, because the corporation is where their bread and butter is. They might kill each other in might kill each other in a bar brawl, but they'll never disagree about the priorities and the prior, and that is what I'm talking about in terms of a global public private partnership.
And that, are they in a fortress, or is there hope in that? Like, where, because I know that you're actually not black-pilled, although you're very raw about the power structure. What do you think is their weakness?
Well, they're not in charge. is their weak? They know they're not in charge. I mean, look what's happened in China over the last week or so. The Chinese government, we have this image, and I think perhaps even the Chinese government itself has this image that it rules with an iron fist, and you know. But when the people came together and said, no, we're not having it anymore, we're not having it, now we look at that they're suddenly, I mean, it's difficult to judge this to what extent, because they were already starting to back off from the COVID restrictions. But it looks like they're backing off more, they're being a bit more amenable, they're sort of giving a bit more. The reason that we have to have all this propaganda, the reason that we're swamped in propaganda, is because in order for any of this stuff to work, we have to be compliant. We have to go along with it. So they their prima facie purpose is to control us. Hence, things systems like technocracy have such appeal because it is about controlling us. It's a system designed to do nothing but control us. So controlling us is vital for their projects to go forward as they want them to. So the question is why? Why is it important? And the answer is, and it must, and something that we have to wrap our heads around, is that if we don't go along with their ideas and their schemes and their plans, and if we don't listen to them, and if we decide we're going to do our own thing, there is nothing they can do about it. Their power is an illusion. Even economic power is an illusion. You know, that we can wrestle that. Well, it's not that we can wrestle that power away. It doesn't exist.
Right.
It only exists because we believe in it.
Yeah, the consent of the governed in a way. And I will tell you the absolute clearest evidence of that, the clearest evidence is how the propaganda just has to be constant, and they need, you need always to have like a screen in your hand. Mm-hmm. It has, it's like, if you have a dog that's out of control, like you've always got to pull it. You always have to pull it on the neck or whatever. Like you can't just, it'll never just heal. And I feel like that the constant propaganda is the tension on the leash that they just can't let up on it, because they put so much energy into it and it gets so ridiculous. But I mean, do you not agree? Like that is the evidence, or is, you know, something else?
No, I do agree. I do. That's how the system operates. It operates by controlling our beliefs, controlling our behavior. It has to operate that way. Hence, we get things like sustainable development, which is predicated upon our belief in something called the climate crisis. And you know, it cannot function if we don't believe it. Right. If we don't believe it, why would we, you know, for example, things like paying increasingly higher fuel prices.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you just say that the only reason that we're paying completely high fuel prices is because they want to price cars off the road, public, private transport off the road, they just want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Which is written, by the way.
Yes.
Which is in their policy documents.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not like it's a secret.
Right.
But they won't announce that to the people, because how would the people react? So instead, it needs to be a justification. It needs to be the breakdown of supply chains. It needs to be, and orchestrating the breakdown of supply chains to justify it. You know, it needs to be the climate, you know, the premium that's put on it for climate change. There needs to be reasons, because without the reasons, if you just came out and said, we are socially engineering all of you, which is the truth.
Yeah.
We are being socially engineered. If they just said that, nobody would go along with it, would they? Everyone would just go, we're not doing it then.
Yeah.
You know, so that is their dilemma. That's their problem. They're not all powerful. That is the great myth. That if there's one thing that we can really shatter the illusion, it is this notion that they are all powerful. They're not.
When you see things like religion and libertarian impulses, they constantly rear their ugly heads. I mean, maybe prophylactic gene therapy will change human nature somehow. I don't know, but
exactly.
So far, no good.
So are we getting to a stage where they can achieve with technology that things that they can, the transhumanist agenda?
That's the question.
Right? So if you can't control us, then literally just reprogram us.